Welcome, everyone. Thank you for attending this briefing on the release of our report, The Top 10 Countries Turning the Corner on Toxic Pollution in 2014. You'll find all the materials. They've just been uploaded and pushed live at www.worstpolluted.org. And there you'll find the full report for download, fact sheets on the 10 projects, photos for reuse, and infographics for reuse. So feel free to use all these materials for your reporting. We're giving you lots of content. We hope you find it useful. So this morning, our speakers will each make a brief remarks, and then we'll open it up to you for questions. We're going to try and stay, brief. It's a large report. It's a lot of information. If during the presentations you'd like to tweet a question, you can use GAP's handle, which is at Health Pollution. So all one word, at Health Pollution. And then we'll Skype it over to our presenters. When anyone who's not speaking should put their phone on mute. So I'll just introduce today's speakers, and then we'll get started. First up is Richard Fuller, the president of Blacksmith Institute for Pure Earth and founding member of GAP. Next up will be David Hanrahan. He's a GAP and Blacksmith senior advisor, an engineer and economist working in development issues and pollution for 30 years. And then Dr. Jack Caravanos will speak. He's our director of research, professor of environmental health for 25 years, and a field practitioner specializing in environmental and health assessments of toxic sites. And Dr. Stefan Robinson will speak next. He's with Green Cross Switzerland. He's the manager of their water projects and legacy pollution projects. And finally, we'll have Natalie Giese, who's the executive director of Green Cross Switzerland. And also an audio file will be available of this briefing after the conference, and if you just email me, I can send it to you or any other colleagues you think might be interested. So let's go ahead and start with Rich Fuller.
Thank you, Angela, and thank you, everyone, for coming along. Can you all hear me okay? So I get off mute?
Yes.
Yep, we can hear you.
Thank you. So thank you all for coming. It's a pleasure to have you all here and talk about pollution in low- and middle-income countries. The astounding thing about pollution is how little it's recognized, how large it is, and how poorly understood it is generally around the world. Pollution, in fact, when you look at WHO numbers, kills 8.9 million people a year, at least it did in 2012. That's one in every seven people. It's easily the largest single risk factor cause of death in the world. It's much bigger than war, much bigger than malaria and TB, smoking even. It is, in fact, the big kahuna of all causes of death. And it kills people from indoor cooking stoves, from outdoor air, causing cardiovascular disease and lung diseases, from contaminated soils, causing all kinds of problems, that, and, of course, sanitation and contaminated water. So the unfortunate thing when you're working overseas, too, is how little countries have dealt with this problem in their own internal agendas. In the West, we're used to having clean water and clean air, knowing that our food is safe. That's just not the case outside of the developed world. You know, in the 60s and 70s, the thrust here of dealing with pollution was enormously successful, and while we still have problems overseas, they haven't gone through that process yet. But as bad as it is, there are examples of terrific results and solutions where people have done the right thing, where countries have worked together with the international community and others and have actually started working along that process. And there's cause for celebration. And that's what this report is. It's a celebrating and acknowledging those countries that have begun the efforts of working on their pollution problems themselves. And while their efforts have been small, they are the beginning, of course, of growing their internal capacity of developing budgets in within their own economic systems to be able to deal with their pollution issues, and slowly winding away at this the single largest killer on the planet. I wanted also to introduce you all to the Global Alliance on Health and Pollution, called GAP, and named so appropriately because of the gap in understanding of this problem. It's a consortium of international agencies and governments dealing or wanting to deal with pollution. So its founding members are the European Commission, World Bank, Asian Development Bank, and Blacksmith Institute for Pure Earth. And it also has all the UN agencies, UNEP, UNIDO, UNDP, and so on. And then about currently about 15 or 20 countries as members as well, including Indonesia and the Philippines and Mexico and many, many others. And GAP exists so countries don't have to deal with pollution on their own. It's a place that where resources can be shared between international agencies and even between countries. And most of the efforts that are going on in the world end up falling under this umbrella. Most of the countries that are moving forward on solving their pollution problems are GAP members and have used GAP alliances to try and begin the process. So it's an effective group, and we're really proud of it and how far it's gone in just a short period of time. I want to point out one other very important thing for you all and your stories. The Sustainable Development Goals are currently in formulation, taking over from the old Millennium Development Goals. And we were a little slow in getting pollution into the agenda, and it's only been in the last 8 months that we've been advocating to make sure that pollution is written in. And given the extent of it, of the health burden that it poses, it really should have had its own goal. Nevertheless, it currently is in draft form, written into the health agenda. And we want to make sure it stays in that, that language stays in the SDGs. Because the SDGs define not just international spending, but often in-country spending in terms of the development agenda. So we've got to make sure that pollution stays in there. So it's very important that the SDGs keep intact, with pollution intact in it. So that's my short, brief report. And I'll pass back over now to David to go through briefly the report. And I'm looking forward to any questions you might have.
Okay, go ahead, David.
Okay, thanks. Thanks, Richard. Good morning, everyone. I'm delighted to participate in this. I'm going to outline briefly the top 10 list, which, as Rich suggested, this year focuses on countries where progress has gone beyond individual projects to broader approaches involving communities, regions, and in a number of cases, national governments. Now, before I just summarize the list, let me set out the process by which the countries were selected. In fact, this is outlined in Annex A of the report, so I'll only touch on it briefly. We started by looking at all the countries that we have included in our global inventory process, and that's nearly 60 countries. And from this, we quickly developed a long list of countries where there's been a successful intervention, there's been some national effort, and also countries which have signed up for the multilateral environment agreements relating to toxic substances, like Stockholm Convention and the recent Minamata Convention. And we gave some additional weight for those that have a record of projects, that have a national action plan or some similar program and are facing up to the challenges. We then took the collaborative approach, which is the fundamental mandate of GAP, and discussed with partners in these countries on the short list where they felt they were, what they could identify as progress, and what specifics they would highlight. And out of that process, together with a concern for geographical representation and also a thematic spread in terms of the issues they were tackling, we came up with the list, which you can see in the report, very quickly, two countries in Africa, which are Ghana and Senegal. There's three in Latin America, Peru, Uruguay, and Mexico. In Asia, we've got Indonesia, the Philippines, and Vietnam. And then in the East, if you like, we put former Soviet Union countries as one heading here, because there's a group of countries which are all tackling the same pesticide issue, which Stephen will comment on later. And Kyrgyzstan is the 10th. And then we've put in for honorable mention three other countries which, for various reasons, don't get into the top 10, India and China, both of whom huge countries, growing very rapidly, struggling with the issues of a growing economy, reducing poverty, feeding the people, and also tackling pollution. So an awful lot going on, but we thought they go in a sort of separate category. Oh, we've included Madagascar, which everybody knows for its wildlife and biodiversity, but which is also beginning to struggle with a lot of pollution issues related to mining and so on, and has decided to come to grips with it. So that's the top 10 plus the honorable mentions. I think we'll go briefly through the individual ones in a moment. So let me just make one quick comment on what we talk about is the resources gap. And the title of the alliance is not coincidentally reflecting the gap idea. What we realize is the more we look at these issues, the bigger the impact of pollution worldwide is, the bigger the numbers of people affected and the economic costs. At the same time, most of the countries that are struggling with this have very limited resources to put into tackling the problems. In some countries, the whole allocation to environment might be 1 to 2% of the national budget. And in smaller, poorer countries, that may amount to no more than a few hundred thousand dollars. And this is very, very small in comparison to what developed countries spend. You look at what in Europe or in North America, protecting our environment from contamination, or indeed it's quite small in relation to resources spent on other international aid flows. So consequently, authorities in all these countries are struggling to try to fit efforts to tackle pollution in with many other priorities they have, hunger, disease, conflict, and so on. And they have to be very efficient in the interventions that they undertake in order to manage to make any progress at all. So for these reasons, GAP focuses very much on achieving real health outcomes as the goal of its interventions. This is one of the focus, probably the main focus in everything we do. And this is the point where I'll pass it over to Dr. Jack Karavanos to talk more about this point.
Thank you, David. Okay, Jack.
Yes, thank you, David. Hello, everybody. My name is Jack Karavanos, and I direct the public health research program at Blacksmith for Pure Earth. My goal for this short session is to describe some of our data gathering and research programs. You probably are aware that the Global Fund for HIV, malaria, TB is estimated at something in the order of $28 billion. But for pollution, it's a rather meager $100 million. And this is sort of understandable because malaria, HIV is quite recognizable, but environmental disease has always been a very difficult and elusive thing to pinpoint. It's hard to look at a cancer, it's hard to look at kidney disease and say that is due to an environmental agent. So this is some of our challenge. It's been a very productive year quantifying the global environmental burden of disease. It all started with WHO's reports of air pollution and its health impact, also the declaration by an international cancer agency, IARC, declaring air pollution being carcinogenic. So you've heard over and over during the year the significance of air pollution. But we are focusing on the other part of that three-legged chair. We have air pollution, water, and of course soil, and that's what we are quantifying. So we added to the value of WHO's estimates, and we, of course, you heard almost 9 million attributable deaths due to things like mercury, lead, toxics, persistent organic pollutants, and the variety of environmental agents. Clearly, lead is one of our most well-researched analytes. And we do this by when we get to our sites, our global toxic site assessments, we collect the necessary info to estimate disease. So as we get to these sites, we collect the level of contamination and proceed to sort of estimate what we call the disability adjusted life years. This disease metric, DALYs, which you will read about in the report and also in some of our many of our publications, combines death and illness into one easily comparable metric. And we do this together with researchers here in New York and also in Boston and also in Washington, University of Washington. So we put together these DALYs. We're getting much more quantitative over the years and trying to accurately assess the impact of global pollution. And this is where you've heard perhaps 94% of the environmental burden of disease is regrettably in low and middle income countries. And I think this number will only get higher given the pollution controls in these countries, as well as the improvements in health in the high income countries. So this is a significant disparity that we're sort of working on. I want to just end by saying that the goal for the year is to refine our health metrics, expand our estimates with different analytes. So we are still working on estimating impacts of pesticides and also artisanal mercury processing. And to basically add to the argument that additional funds need to be addressed for these non-obvious health diseases, these diseases that aren't quite so identifiable. I want to just guide you to many of our publications. They're on our websites. You can Google several of our authors and find these, or you can contact myself or, of course, Angela. We'll get these to you. List some of the burdens for lead in different countries and comparing it to the diseases in those countries. So I want to leave you with the fact that for several countries, environmental pollution is causing more disease than what would commonly be thought. For example, malaria in some countries is not as prevalent, so that lead poisoning is actually causing more harm than something as well known as malaria. But the attention to the resources is different. Okay, I think I'll end there, and you'll hear from me again when I describe two countries and their sort of successes. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Jack. And now we're going over to Dr. Stefan Robinson to start the project review.
Well, welcome. And I actually want to highlight two projects which actually share one commonality, besides that obviously they're both located in the area of the former Soviet Union and share a joint history and development and values. These two projects also highlight that local problems are not only local problems, but that they also can have a regional or even a global impact. So they are very representative for challenges which finally need to be resolved based on a larger strategy. But these are also both projects which show that short-term progress can be done with a very rapid, cost-efficient intervention, which very often is also important to have the help of a local enthusiastic champion who says, I will do that for you on site. On the other hand side, many of these issues can only be resolved if there is a regional or global approach on how to deal with these wastes, and create conditions to stimulate the development of a waste management industry. So the first example I want to look at is Mailu Su in Kyrgyzstan. This is located in Central Asia, and Central Asia is one of the epicenters globally for uranium mining. And Central Asia has today 34 large abandoned uranium mining tailing sites. The threat which comes from these tailings is not necessarily that that the material itself is radioactive, but at the same time it's very often also a heavy metal. So that means besides the radioactive impact on health, it can also cause damage to kidneys, liver, cardiac tissue, or whatever heavy metals have as an impact. Blacksmith and Green Cross are working since many years together in Mailu Su already. And one of our investigations showed that there is certainly an above average rate of cancer cases in the region. And we're wondering, with the limited resources which we have, how could we do an intervention which makes a difference? And obviously the one is to stop the pathway of the uranium to reach people and having negative health impacts. And one of the main pathways is the drinking water. So we have been installing water filters in school and kindergartens, which was a relatively easy and straightforward method, and also given the communities enough water filters so that they can renew them. We have also we have been aware that some of the tailing materials have been used by locals for building their houses. So we have been going to these houses to measure radiation levels in the houses, and where the levels were above the limits, we were installing radiation shields. And unfortunately, in case of four families, the levels were so high that they had to be resettled. We had also been undertaking health investigation of risk groups, so that means mainly children and youth, because they are the most affected, because their immune system is not yet so strong as with an adult. But so putting, investigating the health and the ones where we had health concerns, putting them into a group which we were monitoring over several years to improve the health. And finally, this all doesn't help unless people understand that the tailings are dangerous and they shouldn't be going to the tailings. So a strong component obviously also in the education and the public outreach. That brings me now to the other topic, that's the one of obsolete pesticides, which essentially is a problem which affects almost any country in the world. But I think it's quite nicely highlighted by the example of Tomsk, and it showed how local progress is important to tackle a global challenge. Many of the older pesticides are extremely dangerous because they do globally migrate. So if, for example, DDT has been formerly used in Africa, suddenly it was found in Greenland, though in Greenland there is no agriculture. So obviously many of the pesticides globally migrate. Now, our efforts are to say we have enormous challenges. In the former Soviet Union, we speak about hundreds of thousands, probably even millions of tons of old pesticides which are not usable anymore, which are legacy sites. Nobody really cares about them, but they are a threat to the health. So we are introducing best international standards as they have been developed by the UN Food and Agriculture Organization, FAO, in managing these issues. This is a cycle essentially where you try first to inventorize your problem so that you understand what is the scale of the problem. Then you rank your risks. Then with a limited budget, you know where are the biggest risks which you need to address first. And then we train people, how can you safely repack these materials, and ultimately what are the options they have to dispose of these materials in a safe way for both the health of the people and the environment. In Tomsk, the problem is mainly today buried DDT, which has been used largely in forestry. And so we have been training a local team which has been contacting us from Tomsk, which works closely with the regional administration, how to inventorize DDT. And last autumn we had a training how to assess risks which come from big landfills, because we suspect that probably several 10,000 of tons of obsolete pesticide have been buried some decades ago, and it's important to find them again so that to stop them doing harm to the environment and the health. So we hope that in spring 2015 we will be able to find these landfills, and then in the course of the next 1-2 years develop a strategy and repackage safely these dangerous amounts. And that's where I want to give over to the next person.
Okay, thank you, Stefan. All right, now we go back to Dr. Jack Caravanos, and he's going to talk about the projects in Ghana and Montevideo.
Yes, thank you. Agbogbloshie in Ghana is a site that I've been to many times, and we've struggled over the years to impact change. It's a large scrapyard and recycling market in the center of Accra, right next to a wholesale vegetable market. It's a tremendously complicated site where people are processing e-waste coming from everything from toasters to computers to refrigerators, as well as dismantling engines. So there's a variety of contaminants there and health impacts associated with them. And we've been quantifying some of those with the local health ministry. But I'm really happy to say that over the years, we've, with our planning and our connections there and our partners, we have some strong partners in Accra, we've been able to get them to dedicate some land at the scrapyard, put up containers, and inside the containers, electrically powered wire stripping machines that are literally making the processing of plastic, taking the plastic off the wires, safer, faster, overall better for the environment, worker health, and of course the health of the community, as well as poverty reduction and setting up entrepreneurial relationships in the market. So it all started with trying to use manual wire stripping devices. That was found to be difficult to implement. And then we got some grants to try installing the electrical units. Of course, that gets complicated. You need electricity. You need training. There are safety issues concerned. But it's a wonderful success story, and I'm happy and thrilled to say that we're on our way to turning this very notorious, infamous waste site into really a recycling market, state of the art. And Green Advocacy Ghana, the National Youth Authority, the Ghana Energy Commission, everybody is a partner in this, and it's looking very, very good. So we're thrilled with some of that. Ultimately, our next step as a researcher is to sort of quantify some of the health gains as well as some of the economic gains here, and we'll do that shortly. The next success story, if I may, is Montevideo in Uruguay. This is rather challenging because it's a backyard smelting and e-waste processing in an urban area. About 15,000 people are sort of involved in this. And over the past several years, we've identified hotspots and done targeted remediations using our partners in the city and some researchers from the local university. By the end of 2014, the hotspots that we identified in this one community have been eliminated. Fortunately, they're rather small, but they're extremely numerous. So there's many of these small sites around town. We don't have funds to clean up every hotspot in Montevideo, but I think part of what we try to do is catalyze action so that people can sort of take this activity over with our technical support. So these partners, the EU, UNIDO, and GAP, all sort of got this program up and running. And, of course, part of the assessment is to measure blood lead levels because most of these backyard smelters were battery recyclers, to measure blood levels as an outcome of success. And it looks like preliminary data shows that it is going down for the people that were in these markets. So the wonderful thing with environmental remediation, especially in lead, is that you could see a rather quick change in blood lead levels when the hazard is removed. So we're continuing to monitor that success. Okay, so those are the two that I was doing at Bobloche in Ghana and Montevideo in Uruguay. Thank you.
Okay, Jack, and now back over to David Hanrahan, and he's going to briefly review Vietnam and the Philippines.
Yeah, thanks, Angela. I'll be very brief because I know we're running on, but I want to note both of these examples, Vietnam and the Philippines, as very good examples of things building up from a small start. So in Vietnam, if you see in the report, we have been looking at the village of Dong Mai for several years. It's one of the well-known craft villages in Vietnam, which is really a small industry cluster. They work on recycling lead-acid batteries. They used to break them up in their homes. They were aware of the problems, but weren't really sure how to keep the industry going and keep having their incomes while protecting their health. We've worked with them. The local community has moved to a cooperative area outside the town. We've been working in great detail with them recently to identify and clean up the homes and the houses that are most contaminated. That's gone really well. I think the point I want to just flag is we've had the very strong involvement of the Ministry of Environment, of their technical center, who've developed and helped to train a lot of the techniques and the processes there. And now, following very successful cleanup of of the area that we started with, the government themselves have cleaned up the rest of the town, essentially, and are now designing a program to take on some of the other several hundred craft villages in Vietnam. So I personally, having been there quite a few times, I think generally we're very, very pleased at the way the things have gone in Vietnam. Somewhat similarly in the Philippines, we started 5 or 6 years ago with a couple of small cleanup projects, particularly a lead smelter on the banks of the Marilao River, which is part of this Marilao, Macawayan, and Obando, or the MMO river system. It went from that to building local relationships with the government and the industry sectors, with the local government and with the central government. As a result of all of this, that river basin became the first river basin committee established in the Philippines with a focus on protecting the river system. One of the major issues they identified was aquaculture. A very large volume of fish is produced both to feed Manila and also for export. So currently, as described in the report, we're doing a large project with the support of HSBC, the bank, working with the aquaculture industry to find ways to ensure that the fish ponds are protected from the more highly polluted waters. So again, we see that as a great step up from the early efforts that were put into trying to get a small project off the ground to the point now where it's a regional effort. So let me stop there. I've got a question in on Twitter from Endrawati in Indonesia, who's referring to one of the other projects, saying, do we have any data for Chinanka Village in Indonesia after the original data quoted? The answer there is we just finished a cleanup project in Indonesia in Chinanka, which we're very pleased with. again with the strong support of the local and the regional government of Bogor. And to the best of my knowledge, the local government is out there round about this time doing post-project monitoring. So hopefully that data will be out and made available, but the information I have is that the cleanup has been really successful. So back to you, Angela.
Okay, thanks, David. Okay, and our last speaker is Natalie Giese, and she's going to make a few comments on the overall environmental agenda issues. Go ahead, Natalie.
Thank you very much, Angela. As said, pollution globally kills more than 8.9 million people each year, most of them children, and nearly all, 8.4 million in low- and middle-income countries. Concretely, that's almost three times more deaths than malaria and 14 times more deaths than HIV or AIDS. While pollution kills about 9 million people each year globally, the best and most cited estimate for lives lost due to climate change is 5 million in 2010, according to DARAS and other NGOs, 2012 Climate Vulnerability Monitor. However, the majority of these climate deaths, at least 4 million, are the result of outdoor and indoor air pollution, according to DARA. This means these 4 million deaths are caused by particulates from power plants, cars, and trucks, which contaminate outdoor air, and smoke from burning coal, wood, and other biomass in homes for cooking and heating. About 1 million of those 5 million deaths were attributable to direct climate impacts, including deaths by environmental disasters, by extreme heat and drought from climate change resulting in food spoilage and shortages, and by heat and cold illnesses. In recent years, climate change has deservedly focused the world's attention. Industrialized nations have agreed to provide $10.4 billion in funding for 2015 to help low- and middle-income countries reduce their carbon dioxide emissions and adapt to the impacts of climate change. This is many times greater than the current investment in pollution reduction in these countries. All nations have also agreed to make major investments to halt the dangerous decline of biodiversity. Concretely, in 2010, governments have agreed on a set of 20 biodiversity targets. The estimated cost of implementing those targets is between $150 and $440 billion US dollars per year. Just protecting wetlands would cost approximately $33 billion US dollars per year. So overall, climate and biodiversity expenditures dwarf pollution reduction funding. Similar global investment, though, in pollution reduction and cleaning up toxic sites would not only lead to better health for tens of millions of people, it would also improve the well-being of the natural ecosystem in which we all live and on which we all depend. Nature's green infrastructure, consisting of trees, plants, and other organisms, so-called biodiversity, provides us with oxygen and keeps air and water clean. It stems floods, limits the negative impact of droughts, and not least, it is a vital source of food and building materials. But it is impossible to have healthy, functional wetlands or forests if they are exposed to high concentrations of heavy metals, toxic pesticides or radioactive waste. Moreover, the fact that, as we heard, more than one out of seven deaths worldwide is related to environmental toxins offers just a glimpse of the enormous consequential health and economic costs resulting from the contamination of human habitats. Approximately 200 million people are suffering from frequently irreparable injuries to the body, including the brain, due to exposure to lead, mercury, chromium, pesticides, and radionuclides in thousands of contaminated places. In this way, billions of dollars are lost to soaring health costs and lost productivity. Air pollution alone cost China more than $900 billion in 2013. That's 10% of the country's annual GDP. Regardless of this magnitude and the severe consequences for humans, again, only a fraction of the financial investments and actions is spent on environmental contamination compared to the three global infectious diseases, malaria, HIV, AIDS, and tuberculosis, and as said, the two environmental problems spanning the globe, climate change and extinctions of species. Pollution is not a priority concern in poorer countries, in part because pollution is often invisible to the eye and rarely leaves clear fingerprints on its victims. Therefore, countries aren't aware, too, of the full costs that pollution steals from its people and economy. Equally, rich countries, multilateral agencies and organizations have forgotten the crippling impact of pollution and fail to make it a priority in their foreign assistance because this goes back to the 50s and the 60s in their history. It is difficult to see, though, how countries can achieve the proposed Sustainable Development Goals, the so-called SDGs, without tackling pollution. The enormous health, economic, and social cost burden from toxic pollution cripples their development potential. And it was therefore a significant victory for the authors of this year's Environmental Toxin Report to see that Sustainable Development Goals addressing contamination are currently discussed. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you, Natalie. Okay, journalists, now it's your chance to answer questions. Thank you for listening so patiently. Sorry we went a little long. So who would like to ask a question?
I have a question for Richard Fuller. It's Gabrielle from SciDevNet.
Okay.
Richard, you mentioned the post-2015 Sustainable Development Agenda. What's actually happened so far in the business and recognized? What meetings, reports, advocacy mechanisms have actually taken place so far? Where are we with that?
We're in the final stages. There's been 3 or 4 years worth of meetings that have gone on with many different groups. The working group has had meetings here in New York over the last 12 months about every 2 months or so, culling down now to, I think there's 15 goals that have been...
What wins have you had?
We got a change in the health goal where now there's a line in the health goal which says good health for all. Forgive me if I'm just talking off the top of my head. But now one of the sub-goals, 3.9, reads reduce death and disease from all kinds of pollution, air, water, and soil. By X percent by a certain year. But we're looking to have that be defined further in this year so that it's reducing the amount of death and disease from pollution by 50%. That's very doable, I think, if we're looking at something in 2020. So far that line puts a hard, measurable indicator out there to reduce the burden of disease for all kinds of pollution. That's what we want to have stay. Do you want me to? I can send you that text as well.
Thanks.
Yeah. Angela, could we get that out to everyone?
Sure.
Okay. That's what we need to have stick.
Okay. More questions? Anything?
Yes, I have a question. This is Jennifer Madden from durablehuman.com. I wanted to know if those e-wastes in the various countries are from the United States or are they local to that continent?
I can answer that if you like. I've just been through this question recently. The majority of them are local and domestic. What you will find, though, is a lot of the computers that are there will have a U.S. origin originally. What happens with a used computer is often it's sold and shipped overseas to a poorer country. It'll be used for a year or two, and then when it fails, it'll end up going back to the scrap heap. So that qualifies it for it being a domestic used computer. So the amount of stuff that's actually shipped over in a clandestine way from Western countries to these overseas dump heaps has reduced dramatically since most of the corporate community has kind of been against that that whole dumping of e-waste overseas. So does that answer the question okay?
Yeah, it does. And then a follow-up I would have is the you didn't talk about Mexico City, but you're trying to replace the lead glazing on the pottery with a non-lead glazing technique. Are those primarily exported, a lot of that pottery?
No, none of it is export as far as we know. In fact, there are quite strong controls at the U.S. border to check Mexican pottery to make sure it isn't lead. That was done about 15, 20 years ago. So this is only domestic. And again, that exposure is quite enormous. We just recently published results of looking at lead levels in Mexican population by looking at evaluating over the last 15 years. And on average, the lead levels in the average Mexican person are 8 times what they are in the U.S. So that has a long-term implication then for lower intelligence, increased violence, and other kinds of cardiovascular diseases.
And so do you think that the salsa is not exported to the U.S. either?
That pottery is not exported as far as we know. We're pretty sure they're checking it all pretty vigorously at the border.
What about the salsa that's being contaminated?
I don't know about that. I wouldn't be surprised if some of it slips through, but I hope that there's pretty decent controls. I don't know about the salsa, I'm sorry.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, we have another question that came in from Twitter from a journalist at IPS. And the question for Green Cross Switzerland is, do wealthier countries have an obligation to assist poor nations in remediation technology transfer, and who's doing the best job on this front?
Maybe I can start with the first part of the question, whether we have an obligation. And then I give it to people who are running programs for who is doing the best job.
Okay.
Because they are in the country. So I think, yes, of course, wealthier countries do have an obligation to assist poor nations in remediation technology transfer and generally assist in overcoming this burden of pollution. And this is because, contrary to popular belief, many of the worst pollution problems are not caused by multinational companies, but by poorly regulated small-scale operations like artisanal small-scale gold mining or battery recycling or abandoned factories. But we all in high-income countries are indirectly contributing to the problem in a significant way, as demand for commodities and consumer goods is largely driven by the economies of high-income countries. And those countries that support many of these badly managed and regulated and polluting smaller industries, adding to the severity of pollution problems and making them grow in low-income countries. And in addition, we here in the West, in the high-income countries, have had success in cleaning up our toxic sites and legacy pollution, and we can therefore transfer technology and know-how to those other countries. We have something to give. They desperately need. And also, many problems have been solved in our countries, so those middle and low-income countries really come next to receive some help.
Thank you, Natalie.
If I can just jump in as well, some of these problems do come back to our shores. You know, the fish we eat has mercury in it, for example. So we have an obligation to our own people to make sure that air that's coming into Los Angeles now is filled with particulates from China. There are many examples where the world is in fact one entity, and all these things do end up coming back to us. So we have to be concerned about that as well.
Okay. Any other questions from journalists?
Yeah, well, I think there was also a second part in the question about champions or who is the most important. And I don't think there is a simple answer. This one is the best, and then number two and number three are those. But I think pollution is an area where it's specifically important to work in partnerships. And I've been presenting the issue of pesticides, and I think that's a very nice example how important partnerships are. If we look at how we address today pesticides, it has all been driven by the establishment of the Stockholm Convention in 2004. So when the global community is understood, many of the old pesticides are globally mobile, or as just Richard has said, similar to mercury is mobile, and we have to address that on a global level. So then came obviously the question, how do we address that? And I think what's very important, if you work in pollution, you have not to do it in an improvised way, but you should really look in what would be our large-scale strategy and the long-term aims we want to reach, and how do we get there? What's the way to that? And I think that must be something which is planned very systematically. And for FAO has been now really the UN organization which has been defining the global best practices, how you manage obsolete pesticides. On the other hand side, FAO, that means these are 3-4 people in Rome. Obviously, they cannot solve the global obsolete pesticides problem. So what they do now is obviously to build up a network where you have, for example, donor organizations like the CEF or the European Commission, but then also work with the governments, because ultimately they are the problem holders and they have to understand how to work with these wastes and how to integrate this into the longer terms operations and strategic frameworks of the governments. But a lot of these things are also happening in local communities. So we have to reach out to communities to work with them. So there's a lot of information work done through a network of NGOs. So I think it's not the question who is the best, but I think it's important that you create good, effective networks of people who are eager to resolve these problems. So I hope that was a long answer, but it makes sense.
Yes, it does. Thank you, Stefan. Okay, any other questions? I know we've lost some folks. I just want to make sure everyone gets a chance to ask their questions.
In the case of the Ghana project, this question is probably for Dr. Jack Caravano. Is the modern recycling machinery used for processing the e-waste in Ghana a recent innovation, or have we had that technology for a while?
Well, the technology has been available. Logistically, it was problematic getting it in this particular site. Everything from this, it's a large landfill type of site, soft soil, muddy, getting the containers there, getting the electricity there, the 220 voltages, the high voltages we need for these machines, as well as security for the area. So luckily, the Greater Accra Scrap Dealers Association, who runs this yard together with the National Youth Authority, made some commitments. They gave us some land. They built fences. We bought the containers. So it's really using old technology in a new place.
There was no previous investment, right?
No, not at all. This is the first time this type of recycling, automated recycling of any type, has been attempted at this site. You have hundreds of individual people chopping away at devices, but now it's all been unified and systematized. And we're hoping that beyond just the wire stripping machines that we purchased and installed and had them trained, we're moving to recycling, getting chippers so that the plastic shells for the computers would be crushed and then shipped out, and also creating a complete recycling stream, not just a copper, but also the plastic and also the ABS plastics.
And by the way, guys, this is not rocket science. This is exactly what happens in other places as they begin to formalize the industry and make it less polluting. So this is what's happened in China, to a certain lesser extent in India, over the last 5 or 6 years as e-waste has begun to be handled better. So we're just hand-holding them through a very well-known process.
Okay, any other questions? Is everyone off mute who's trying to ask a question, or are we all set? Shall we wrap up?
I guess I can ask one last question.
Please.
Wondering about China and India, and can you just generalize why you put them on the list? Is there something in particular they're going after?
Yeah, I can speak to this a lot. We have a lot of operation to work going on in both of those countries, and they've both been working pretty hard on this, at least in planning stages. You know, in China, they've spent many billions of dollars on their air quality issues, and they've made some inroads. They've moved a lot of polluting factories, shut down a lot of coal-fired power plants around centers, and now they're no longer as bad as they were. They're still absolutely awful, don't get me wrong, but they've made quite a lot of inroads on their outdoor air pollution issues. From their soil pollution side of things, they've started. The first thing they did was they've commissioned an analysis of all of their contaminated sites. And it is a very strong, solid platform moving forward for them. And over the next 5 years, they're planning to spend many billions of dollars on their soil contamination issues as well. So, you know, while we all like to jump up and down and say how rotten China is, in fact, they really are on the way and doing quite well. Now, India has been making the right noises also. The new government that's in there right now has revamped their plans on sanitation. They'll be spending many billions of dollars in cleaning up the Ganges. I know this has been ongoing for many years, but we've got good faith that perhaps this will happen better this time. They're also beginning at least to analyze their air quality problems. Well, they haven't really yet begun to implement any significant changes except for changing their diesel fuel over this year to a higher grade diesel fuel. There are good things that are going on in India. They're in a bit earlier stage, a little bit behind what's going on in China, but they are moving forward. You can just tell by the size of their environmental agencies working on pollution, and both those countries now have substantive agencies that are really coming to the international community through GAP now for quite complex technical issues rather than for that actual startup. How do we get going? It's more like how do we deal with a cadmium concentration level, or how do we deal with this particular pesticide cleanup in this kind of site? So you know, these are good things.
Okay, thank you.
Hi, Angela. This is Jack. I have an email from someone with a couple of questions. Should we handle these here, or would you like me to email her back, or?
Are they brief questions or?
Yeah, I think also Rich is
why don't
on
we,
there. I think.
That. Why don't we email her back for that? That's because there's like five.
Oh, that's like eight questions.
Exactly.
No, we'll do that with email.
Yeah.
And any reporters on the line, if you want to send additional questions, feel free to email me, Meg, or Angela.
Good.
What, Jack?
Meg. Yes, Meg. There's one question that I do feel the entire group should get the answer to, and that's regarding coordinating with child health experts in the cases of affected children. So you should know that we have an IRB in place. We had an external one. Now we have a more internal IRB, Institutional Review Board for Ethical Behavior and Research, and our projects go through this. And one of the issues is when we find poisoned children, what happens? It's a very important ethical issue not to just abandon these children, and we do coordinate with the local health ministries for proper intervention, both medical intervention as well as environmental intervention. So when we see poisoned children in Mexico, at a certain level, we follow the CDC guidelines, and they are channeled to the proper health authorities. So that's a very important aspect of what we do at Blacksmith. Thank you.
Okay. Yeah, that's great that that came up. Thank you. No,
we'd feel sick if we found kids that were sick and we weren't looking after them. It'd be just terrible. So we don't do that.
Okay, anything else? All right. So any additional questions that people have, feel free to send emails to myself, Angela Bernhardt, or Mag. You should have our emails with all the materials, the conference registration materials that we sent. And if you also want to do one-on-one interviews with any of the speakers, we're happy to set that up and go into the detail of any more projects. And so I think we're done. All right. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
And,
all.
Thank you.
No. Ending. Okay.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Bye.
Okay. Bye. Bye.